Chapter 60. Surely whoever speaks to me in the right voice, him or her I shall follow. As the water follows the moon, silently, with fluid steps anywhere around the globe. Walt Whitman. Now my cousins are at Diplo, said Grandcourt. Will you go there? Tomorrow? The carriage shall come for Mrs. Davilo. You can tell me what you would like, done in the rooms. Things must be put in decent order while we are away at Rylands. And tomorrow is the only day. He was sitting sideways on a sofa in the drawing room at Offenden, one hand and elbow resting on the back, and the other hand thrust between his cross knees in the attitude of a man who is much interested in watching the person next to him. Gwendolyn, who had always disliked needlework, had taken to it with apparent zeal since her engagement, and now held a piece of white embroidery which, on examination, would have shown many false stitches. During the last 8 or 9 days their hours had been chiefly spent on horseback, but some margin had always been left for this more difficult sort of companionship, which, however, Gwendolyn had not found disagreeable. She was very well satisfied with Grandcourt. His answers to her lively questions about what he had seen and done in his life bore drawling very well. From the first as he had noticed that he knew what to say, and she was constantly feeling not only that he had nothing of the fool in his composition, but that by some subtle means he communicated to her the impression that all the folly lay with other people who did what he did not care to do. A man who seems to have been able to command the best has a sovereign power of depreciation. Then Grandcourt's behavior as a lover had hardly at all passed the limit of an amorous homage which was inobtrusive as a wafted odor of roses, and spent all its effects in a gratified vanity. One day, indeed, he had kissed not her cheek but her neck a little below her ear, and Gwendolyn, taken by surprise, had started up with a marked agitation which made him rise to and say, I beg your pardon, did I annoy you? Oh, it was nothing, said Gwendolyn, rather afraid of herself, only I cannot bear to be kissed under my ear. She sat down again with a little playful laugh, but all the while she felt her heart beating with a vague fear. She was no longer at liberty to flout him as he had flouted poor X. Her agitation seemed not uncomplimentary, and he had been contented not to transgress again. Today a slight rain hindered writing, but to compensate, a package had come from London, and Mrs. Davilo had just left the room, after bringing in for admiration the beautiful things of Grandcourt's ordering, which lay scattered about on the tables. Gwendolyn was just then enjoying the scenery of her life. She let her hands fall on her lap, and said with a pretty air of perversity, why is tomorrow the only day? Because the next day is the first with the hounds, said Grandcourt. And after that? After that I must go away for a couple of days, it's a bore, but I shall go one day, and come back the next. Grandcourt noticed a change in her face, and releasing his hand from under his knees, he laid it on hers, and said, you object to my going away? It's no use objecting, said Gwendolyn, coldly. She was resisting to the utmost her temptation to tell him that she suspected to whom he was going, the temptation to make a clean breast, speaking without restraint. Yes it is, said Grandcourt, enfolding her hand. I will put off going, and I will travel at night, so as only to be away one day. He thought that he knew the reason of what he inwardly called this bit of temper, and she was particularly fascinating to him at this moment. Then don't put off going, but travel at night, said Gwendolyn, feeling that she could command him, and finding in this peremptoriness a small outlet for her irritation. Then you will go to Diplo tomorrow? Oh, yes, if you wish it, said Gwendolyn, in a high tone of careless assent. Her concentration in other feelings had really hindered her from taking notice that her H and was being held. How you treat us poor devils of men, said Grandcourt, lowering his tone. We are always getting the worst of it. Are you? Said Gwendolyn, in a tone of inquiry, looking at him more naively than usual. She longed to believe this commonplace badinage as the serious truth about her lover. In that case, she too was justified. If she knew everything, Mrs. Glasher would appear more blamable than Grandcourt. Are you always getting the worst?
Yes.
Are you as kind to me as I am to you? Said Grandcourt, looking into her eyes with his narrow gaze. Gwendolyn felt herself stricken. She was conscious of having received so much that her sense of command was checked and sank away in the perception that, look around her as she might, she could not turn back. It was as if she had consented to mount a chariot where another held the reins, and it was not in her nature to leap out in the eyes of the world. She had not consented in ignorance, and all she could say now would be a confession that she had not been ignorant. Her right to explanation was gone. All she had to do now was to adjust herself so that the spikes of that unwilling penance which conscience imposed should not gall her. With a sort of mental shiver, she resolutely changed her mental attitude. There had been a little pause, during which she had not turned away her eyes, and with a sudden break into a smile, she said, "If I were as kind to you as you are to me, that would spoil your generosity. It would no longer be as great as it could be, and it is that now." "Then I am not to ask for one kiss," said Grandcourt, contented to pay a large price for this new kind of love-making, which introduced marriage by the finest contrast. "Not one?" said Gwendolyn, getting saucy, and nodding at him defiantly. He lifted her little left hand to his lips, and then released it respectfully. Clearly it was faint praise to say of him that he was not disgusting. He was almost charming, and she felt at this moment that it was not likely she could ever have loved another man better than this one. His reticence gave her some inexplicable, delightful consciousness. "Apropos," she said, taking up her work again, "is there anyone besides Captain and Mrs. Torrington at Diplo, or do you leave them tete-a-tete? I suppose he converses in cigars," and she answers with her chignon. "She has a sister with her," said Grandcourt, with his shadow of a smile, "and there are two men besides one of them you know, I believe."
"Ah, then, I have a poor opinion of him," said Gwendolyn, shaking her head.
"You saw him at Lubran Young Deronda, a young fellow with the Malingers." Gwendolyn felt as if her heart were making a sudden gambol, and her fingers, which tried to keep a firm hold on her work, got cold.
"I never spoke to him," she said, dreading any discernible change in herself.
"Is he not disagreeable?"
"No, not particularly," said Grandcourt, in his most languid way. "He thinks a little too much of himself. I thought he had been introduced to you."
"No. Someone told me his name the evening before I came away. That was all."
"What is he?"
"A sort of ward of Sir Hugo Malinger's. Nothing of any consequence."
"Oh, poor creature. How very unpleasant for him," said Gwendolyn, speaking from the lip and not meaning any sarcasm.
I wonder if it has left off raining," she added, rising and going to look out of the window. Happily it did not rain the next day, and Gwendolyn rode to Diplo on Criterion as she had done on that former day when she returned with her mother in the carriage. She always felt the more daring for being in her riding dress, besides having the agreeable belief that she looked as well as possible in it, a sustaining consciousness in any meeting which seems formidable. Her anger toward Deronda had changed into a superstitious dread due, perhaps, to the coercion he had exercised over her thought lest the first interference of his in her life might foreshadow some future influence. It is of such stuff that superstitions are commonly made. An intense feeling about ourselves which makes the evening star shine at us with a threat, and the blessing of a beggar encourage us. And superstitions carry consequences which often verify their hope or their foreboding. The time before luncheon was taken up for Gwendolyn by going over the rooms with Mrs. Torrington and Mrs. Davilow, and she thought it likely that if she saw Deronda, there would hardly be need for more than a bow between them.
She meant to notice him as little as possible. And after all, she found herself under an inward compulsion too strong for her pride. From the first moment of their being in the room together, she seemed to herself to be doing nothing but notice him. Everything else was automatic performance of an habitual part. When he took his place at lunch, Grandcourt had said, "Deronda, Miss Arleth tells me you were not introduced to her at Lubrin." "Miss Arleth hardly remembers me, I imagine," said Deronda, looking at her quite simply, as they bowed. "S.G. was intensely occupied when I saw her." Now, did he suppose that S.G. had not suspected him of being the person who redeemed her necklace? "On the contrary. I remember you very well," said Gwendolyn, feeling rather nervous, but governing herself and looking at him in return with new examination. "Why, you did not approve of my playing at roulette." "How did you come to that conclusion?" said Deronda, gravely. "Oh, you cast an evil eye on my play," said Gwendolyn, with a turn of her head and a smile. "I began to lose, as soon as you came to look on. I had always been winning till then." "Roulette in such a kennel as Lubrin is a horrid bore," said Grandcourt. "I found it a bore when I began to lose," said Gwendolyn. Her face was turned toward Grandcourt as she smiled and spoke, but she gave a sidelong glance at Deronda, and saw his eyes fixed on her with a look so gravely penetrating, that it had a keener edge for her than his ironical smile at her losses, a keener edge than Klezmer's judgment. She wheeled her neck round, as if she wanted to listen to what was being said by the rest, while she was only thinking of Deronda. His face had that disturbing kind of form and expression which threatens to affect opinion, as if one's standard was somehow wrong. Who has not seen men with faces of this corrective power till they frustrated it by speech or action? His voice, heard now for the first time, was to Grandcourt's toneless drawl, which had been in her ears every day, as the deep notes of a violoncello to the broken discourse of poultry and other lazy gentry in the afternoon sunshine. Grandcourt, she inwardly conjectured, was perhaps right in saying that Deronda thought too much of himself. A favorite way of explaining a superiority that humiliates. However, the talk turned on the Rinderpest and Jamaica, and no more was said about roulette. Grandcourt held that the Jamaica Negro was a beastly sort of Baptist Caliban. Deronda said he had always felt a little with Caliban, who naturally had his own point of view, and could sing a good song. Mrs. Davilow observed that her father had an estate in Barbados, but that she herself had never been in the West Indies. Mrs. Torrington was sure she should never sleep in her bed if she lived among blacks. Her husband corrected her by saying that the blacks would be manageable enough if it were not for the half-breeds, and Deronda remarked that the whites had to thank themselves for the half-breeds. While this polite pea-shooting was going on, Gwendolyn trifled with her jelly and looked at every speaker in turn that she might feel at ease in looking at Deronda. "I wonder what he thinks of me, really? He must have felt interested in me, else he would not have sent me my necklace. I wonder what he thinks of my marriage? What notions has he to make him so grave about things? Why has he come to Diplo?" These questions ran in her mind as the voice of an uneasy longing to be judged by Deronda with unmixed admiration, a longing which had had its seed in her first resentment at his critical glance. Why did she care so much about the opinion of this man who was owing of any consequence? As he had no time to find the reason she was too much engaged in caring. In the drawing room, when something had called Grandcourt away, she went quite unpremeditatedly up to Deronda, who was standing at a table apart, turning over some prints, and said to him, "Shall you hunt tomorrow, Mr. Deronda?" "Yes, I believe so." "You don't object to hunting, then?" "I find excuses for it. It is a sin I am inclined to when I can't get boating or cricketing." "Do you object to my hunting?" said Gwendolyn, with a saucy movement of the chin. "I have no right to object to anything you choose to do." "You thought you had a right to object to my gambling," persisted Gwendolyn. "I was sorry for it. I am not aware that I told you of my objection, said Deronda, with his usual directness of gaze, a large-eyed gravity, innocent of any intention. His eyes had a peculiarity which has drawn many men into trouble. They were of a dark yet mild intensity which seemed to express a special interest in everyone on whom he fixed them, and might easily help to bring on him those claims which ardently sympathetic people are often creating in the minds of those who need help. In mendicant fashion we make the goodness of others a reason for exorbitant demands on them. That sort of effect was penetrating Gwendolyn. You hindered me from gambling again, she answered. But as he had no sooner spoken than she blushed over face and neck, and Deronda blushed too, conscious that in the little affair of the necklace he had taken a questionable freedom. It was impossible to speak further, and she turned away to a window, feeling that as he had stupidly said, what as he had not meant to say, and yet being rather happy, that as he had plunged into this mutual understanding. Deronda also did not like it. Gwendolyn seemed more decidedly attractive than before, and certainly there had been changes going on within her since that time at Lubrin. The struggle of mind attending a conscious error had wakened something like a new soul, which had better, but also worse, possibilities than her former poise of crude self-confidence. Among the forces as he had come to dread, was something within her that troubled satisfaction. That evening Mrs. Davilow said, was it really so, or only a joke of yours, about Mr. Deronda spoiling your play, Gwen? Her curiosity had been excited, and she could venture to ask a question that did not concern Mr. Grandcourt. Oh, it merely happened that he was looking on when I began to lose, said Gwendolyn, carelessly. I noticed him. I don't wonder at that. He is a striking young man. He puts me in mind of Italian paintings. One would guess, without being told, that there was foreign blood in his veins. Is there? Said Gwendolyn. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.